Okay, Chazara. So, what we learned this semester can be divided up into three categories. One is Olam Haba, Tchias HaMesim, Gan Eden, Gehenem, eschatology, and the like. Number two was Bechiras Yisrael. And number three was what we did today, and also we had several shiurim on it earlier in terms of the Rambam's Mahalach and Agada, Psak and Agada, Pshat versus Drash, and the like, issues relating to Medrash, Agada, and the like. So let's start with Olam Haba, Tchias HaMesim, and the like. So the basic yesod of Olam Haba is the idea of the Nitzchias HaNeshama, and the concept that when a person dies, they continue to exist even after their body is buried and decomposes. That's something that everybody accepts. We did see, though, with respect to the details of what happens and how it happens in the order, there is a great degree of machlokes, and in fact, we have to begin with a question, which is, why should we study these matters anyway? First of all, you might say we shouldn't study them because we can't understand them. Ayin lo rasa lo kim zulasecha, the Gemara says, that it's impossible to understand Olam Haba. We could understand Yemos HaMashiach, which is a this-worldly reality, but not Olam Haba. Number two is that the Rambam writes that no depictions of Olam Haba could do it justice anyway. We can't understand it because it's a non-physical existence, it's a spiritual existence. Even if you understand, like the Ramban, that there's a physical body, but it's still a spiritual existence. Two is that the Ramban writes, "Velo dimua neviim kedei shelo yifchesu osa b'dimayon." Simply trying to depict it takes away from it. Because whatever depictions or analogies we give can't possibly correspond to the true reality. Three is that we shouldn't do mitzvos in order to earn Olam Haba. We should do them lishma, and that's another reason given not to study these matters. And four, we talked about the idea expressed in Halachic Man and other works that the halacha focuses on this world. So that being the case, we have four reasons not to study this. So are there any reasons to study this type of topic? So we saw the Bali Musar write that thinking about Olam Haba is something that can practically inspire a person, whether it is to do good or stay away from evil. Another idea is that we saw in the Medrash itself that the belief in Olam Haba is something extremely important. It says that Ha'omer ein tchias ha'meisim en ha'tor ein lo chelek b'olam haba, and the Gemara says that's because hu kafer ba'lefikach lo yelo chelek bo. The denial of Olam Haba is such a grievous error that it warrants ein lo chelek l'olam haba. Why? So the Rama writes, on one level, because denying Olam Haba is denying justice. When we look at this world, we see that we live in a world that doesn't have justice. As we mentioned earlier, the wicked prosper, the righteous suffer, and at least belief in Olam Haba on a basic level is something that is necessary for justice. It's indeed one of the 13 principles of faith according to the Rambam, and that's one reason why it's so important. But there's a more fundamental idea, and as we alluded to earlier today, when we look at the debate between Yaakov and Esav, Chazal understand that it was a debate about Olam Haba. It was a debate about focusing on the here and now. Is all that there is what we see before our eyes? Or is there more to reality? And the perspective of Esav is that of Hine Anochi Holech Lamus, whereas as the Ramban puts it, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we shall die. And the perspective of Yaakov is to see and to recognize that there's much more to existence than what we see, and our 70, 80, 90, or 100 years in this world. And that being the case, the Ramban writes that it is very important to understand these concepts, and in fact, he spends a lot of time doing so. The Shar HaGmul and the like is a major work discussing many of the details of these concepts. The next thing we discussed was that many sources focus on the idea that schar is, and schar v'olam haba is natural and not just compensatory. Meaning to say, as the pasuk says, Adam holach el beis olamo, you build your own world. It's not simply that I get rewarded in payments for the good deeds that I've done and punished for that which I've done that's wrong, but rather it's something that's much more basic. By doing that which is right, I become a person that can experience Olam Haba. And it's much more about a natural consequence than something that is external. We mentioned a joke in class that one person spends his whole life learning, one person spends his whole life wasting his time, they both die, and they go up to Shamayim together, they're taken on a walk, and they're heading for the same room. So the guy who, you know, worked his whole life on learning feels a little bad. He's heading to the same place. Door opens up, and there's a giant base medrash, Yeshiva Shalmala. And so for one it's Olam Haba, and for one it's Gehenim. Same place. And that joke has a lot of truth to it, which is that to the extent that you become a spiritual being while on this world, then you'll be able to experience spirituality in the next world. That which we take with us is that which we've become on this world. Whether you see that in intellectual level, more as the Rambam focuses, the acquired intellect, or a more spiritual level or the like, this is an idea that many sources stress. Ki po'al adam yishalim lo, you get exactly what you've built. And we saw that's true both with respect to reward as well as with respect to punishment. When you taint yourself, the Nefesh HaChaim says that Gehenim exists now around you. You may not notice it. It's not something that exists, but it's something that we build, that we create, and we have to live based off of our experiences. The Ramban writes, we saw that there's a very specific hierarchy based in this naturalistic sense, based off of our motivations. So someone who does mitzvos to be rewarded in this world will be rewarded in this world. Someone who does mitzvos for reward in Olam Haba, so he'll dwell in Gan Eden, but he won't fully experience the pleasures of the next world, because that too is for schar. Someone who does it out of love will experience both this world and that and the next world. And then Ramban writes, someone like Eliyahu, who even while on this world thinks entirely about God and is focused entirely on the spiritual, can reach a level such that there's no stira between his guf and his neshama, such that it doesn't even have to separate upon death. We talked about why Eliyahu reached that madrega, but other tzaddikim didn't, that perhaps there's a need to be involved in this world. We talked about the idea that Chazal tell us that, and this is an expression of what we've been saying, that someone, in dealing with the question of Tzadik v'ralo and Rasha v'tovlo, so Tzadik v'tovlo is a, Rasha v'tovlo is a Rasha Sheinu Gamor, someone who does good things, but is overall bad. So he experiences his reward in this world. And we asked, isn't that unfair? So why should he get rewarded in this world and the tzaddik get rewarded in the next world if reward in the next world is much better than reward in this world? And we answered that a person is rewarded, as this Ramban tells us, based off of what they're interested in. So the Rasha is someone who focuses on this world, as we said. He wants to be rewarded in this world. That's what he's looking for, and therefore he gets exactly what he wants. Not only that, but the good deeds that he does are inherently physically oriented good deeds, and therefore it's appropriate that they be rewarded in the physical world. And likewise, the tzaddik, who's spiritually oriented, not interested in this world, so he experiences his reward where he wants to experience it, namely in Olam Haba. And likewise, the nature of his actions is spiritual, and therefore appropriately the mitzvos are rewarded in Olam Haba. Now, this brings us to the issue of motivation. We saw the Rambam as well as other sources that say that even though we very strongly believe in Olam Haba, a person should not do mitzvos kedesh ezkel chai Olam Haba. This is a low level of avoda. It corresponds to yira, and ideally, at least, a person should be focused on ava. And we noted a number of very important distinctions. First of all, the Rambam also writes that let's take another step first. The Rambam acknowledges that this is a very high level. On the one hand, he writes that who serves God out of yira, avadim, viktanim, and those who serve God out of ava are those that don't serve God to get olam haba. But he says, so who serves God out of ava? This is the madrega of Avram Avinu. So it's very strange. So it sounds like you're either like a low level or you're Avram Avinu. And the Rambam here acknowledges the reality that there's most people are motivated by more than one thing. Avram Avinu's greatness was Lefisha lo avad ela me'ava. But most people are somewhere in between. They're not entirely motivated by reward and punishment, but they should strive to and can achieve to some degree, do achieve success in terms of truer motivation. That's one point. The second point that the Rambam writes is, even though he says that you shouldn't be motivated by Olam Haba, he writes about how David HaMelech longed for Olam Haba, and that the reason why tzaddikim long for Moshe Mashiach is because then they'll be able to learn more Torah and thereby get Olam Haba. So they want Olam Haba. One second, didn't he say that you shouldn't be motivated by Olam Haba? And the distinction that we said is very simple. Reb Tzadok makes this distinction and others, that there's a difference between wanting Olam Haba as reward and wanting Olam Haba because Olam Haba is the ultimate place of Dveikus and Kirva Lelokim. Someone who wants Olam Haba because they want to be close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so that's not something that's bad. Kama kama David. How much David longed for Olam Haba? Not because he wanted to be rewarded for his righteousness, but because he wanted to be close to the Ribono Shel Olam. Whereas what's not the highest level is to yearn for Olam Haba just to be rewarded. So now let's get into some of the details. What actually happens when we die? So first we'll focus on Ramban's position. Ramban understands that when a person dies, they go to the Olam HaNeshamos, which includes Gan Eden and Gehenim, and their soul resides there in the Olam HaNeshamos until Olam Haba is created. Meaning to say that the Olam HaNeshamos, let's say it this way, Gan Eden is not the same thing as Olam Haba. Olam Haba is a Olam Haba, is a future that will, is a world that will exist sometime in the future, and it is the place of ultimate reward, but it doesn't exist now, and when somebody dies now, instead of going to Olam Haba, they go to Gan Eden if they're righteous. When will Olam Haba be created? We'll see later. It will be created following the conclusion of the Messianic era, after the Yom HaDin HaGadol V'Hanorah, Tchias HaMesim, and that will usher in the period of Olam Haba. Now, the Ramban writes that while things will change during Yemos HaMashiach, it's still a fundamentally this worldly experience. In a sense, it's a transition between Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. Olam Haba, like we said, takes place, is created after the Tchias HaMesim. And while both Gan Eden and Olam Haba provide unimaginable opportunities to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu and connect with him, the spiritual existence of Olam Haba is in fact superior, and it is the great hope of all who wish to connect to God and will indeed last forever. Now, how does the Ramban know that there's going to be a physical body in Olam Haba? As we'll see shortly, the Rambam rejects this. The Rambam writes that there is no physical body. Olam Haba exists now. It's probably very similar to what the Ramban describes as Gan Eden. And he says, how do I know that there's no physical body in Olam Haba? Because the Gemara says, Lo ochlin, velo shosin, ela nenin meziv ashchina. There's not eating and drinking and tashmish in Olam Haba. It's all about hana meziv ashchina. Now, if it were the case that there is no eating and drinking, why is there a need for a mouth or a digestive tract or the like? And therefore, the Rambam rejects the idea that there's a physical body in Olam Haba. And intuitively, it strikes us as very strange. So why should there be? So the Ramban writes, we know this, A, because there's a Mesorah. Much of what we know about Olam Haba is based off of tradition. B, it's clear from the Gemara in numerous places that Olam Haba is a place where we have a physical body. One example of this is the Gemara we cited earlier. It says, someone who's kofer b'tchias ha-meisim ain lo chelik Olam Haba. Why? Who kofer ba? He was kofer in tchias ha-meisim. Therefore, lo yeh lo chelik bo, he won't have a chelik in tchias ha-meisim. So we see the Gemara equates tchias ha-meisim and Olam Haba. The Gemara assumes that Olam Haba exists after tchias ha-meisim. Tchias ha-meisim, of course, we have a physical body. And also the Ramban writes, the third point is that we know this based off of scripture. The Psukim tell us that had Adam and Chava not sinned, they would have been able to eat from the Eitz Hadas, Eitz HaChayim, v'chai li'olam. They would have lived forever, meaning say, in their current state with their physical bodies. So, what is the nature of the Guf and the Neshama in Olam Haba? So right now we live with an existence that there's a tension between the guf and the neshama. And Ramban writes there's no inherent reason for this. As we mentioned before, a tzaddik could reach a level where his body is so pure that there is no tension with his neshama. And for the rest of us, where there is a tension, there needs to be a time where that tension can be resolved. And that takes place during the Olam HaNeshamos. So the body decomposes, the neshama is purified, and this allows them to eventually be restored, lasad lavo, in Olam Haba. Likewise, the world has to decompose, and we'll talk about that when we talk about the destruction of the world. So why is there a guf in Olam Haba? After all, like the Rambam asked, if there's no eating and drinking, what need is there for a guf? So he gives a couple of answers. He starts off by saying that after resurrection, before Olam Haba, there'll be a need for a body at the time of judgment. Then he writes a more fundamental answer. V'od yesh b'tzura hazo sodos amukos ki lo haisa hayetzira al zehad mus hefger ulelo tam. We shouldn't just think of the physical body as merely a physical organ. The physical body could lead to deep understandings of God. The body is not just a physical instrument, but reflects divine wisdom. And that will be revealed, lasid lavo. Rambam's rejection of the guf in Olam Haba is rooted in a purely biological evaluation of the purpose of the body. But when we take a more spiritual and mystical understanding of the human body, then we'll see that examining the human body allows us to achieve closeness to God, and that it's something that conveys great truth, and thus will have relevance in Olam Haba. Rabbeinu Bachya adds an additional dimension. It's our physical body that performed the mitzvos through which we earned Olam Haba, and therefore they should partake in its benefit. We invoked the famous Gemara that talks about how the body and the soul are more integrated than perhaps we might think at first. After the body dies, it's buried after the soul dies, it floats around. So the body says, I shouldn't be punished. Look, I haven't sinned since the soul left me. The soul says, I shouldn't be punished because after I've separated from the body, I've floated around, I haven't done anything wrong. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as it were, puts them together and says, it's the two of you that did what you did. And that being the case, we could also understand why, when it comes to the schar, they should once again be reintegrated. Now, we mentioned the Rambam disagrees. He sees Olam Haba as an entirely spiritual existence. Moreover, it currently exists. It's not a future existence. We mentioned what it's based off of, and we talked about the Rambam's focus on intellectual in terms of Olam Haba. What is the nimshal of Atrosam Birosheihem? Kilomar dash yedu shebiglala zachu l'chayeha Olam Haba mitzuya imahen. And we talked about how, though that's true, the Rambam also focuses and stresses the value and the importance in terms of nitzchias of kiyum mitzvos. Then we talked about whether the Rambam denied Tchias HaMesim. So the Rambam famously was accused of denying Tchias HaMesim, and the reason he was accused of this is that it doesn't seem to make sense within his system. After all, imagine a person dies, they're in Olam Haba, the ideal existence, and now they're resurrected and brought back onto this world. That's like sending them to Gehenna. Why and what purpose could there be for Tchias HaMesim? So, of course, the Rambam did not deny Tchias HaMesim. He writes about his belief in Perush HaMishnayos as well as the Mishneh Torah and elsewhere. And he compares those who accuse him of not believing in Tchias HaMesim to those who say that the Trinity is hinted in Shema, that even when HaKadosh Baruch Hu is as clear as possible, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, still people said, look, it's not true, so you shouldn't be surprised that people accuse me of not believing in Tchias HaMesim. After all, I write so as explicitly as possible. So he says, so why didn't I elaborate upon it? And he answers that there's not so much to say on the matter. Tchias HaMesim is going to be a great miracle that will take place. The people that resurrected will live a long life, but will eventually die and return to Olam Haba. Now, what exactly is the purpose of Tchias HaMesim? So, the Ramban suggests that the purpose for Rambam is very similar to what he says is the purpose of Yemos HaMashiach, namely that this world does not always present an equal playing field for everybody with respect to doing Torah and mitzvot. Many people have hard lives, they live short lives, they're persecuted. There's no time to learn Torah and acquire chachma and the like. Yemos HaMashiach, as well as Tchias HaMesim, and Tchias HaMesim may allow all people, all tzaddikim at least, Rambam writes only tzaddikim are resurrected, all tzaddikim to experience Yemos HaMashiach, and thereby have the opportunity to involve themselves in mitzvos and chachma and Torah and earn Olam Haba in a way that they couldn't do so in this world. The reason why denial of Tchias HaMesim is so problematic, such that it warrants Ein Lo Chelek Olam Haba, is because why would someone deny it? Tchias HaMesim, either because they deny God's ability to perform miracles, in other words, they think it's impossible, or they deny the Mesorah, because the Mesorah, though Tchias HaMesim is not stated explicitly in the Torah and only very fleetingly in Nevi'im, we know it really based off of the Mesorah. The Rashba writes in the Tshuva that without the Mesorah we wouldn't know it, we could even interpret the Psukim that refer to Tchias HaMesim allegorically. We know it's true because of the Mesorah, and therefore denial of Tchias HaMesim is either because of denial of the Mesorah, denial of God's powers, both of which are extraordinarily problematic, and that's why the Mishnah says, Ha'omer ein Tchias HaMesim in HaTorah, ein lo chelek li'olam haba. What is Gan Eden according to the Ramban? According to Ramban, Gan Eden and Olam Haba are probably synonyms, though that might not be so simple as we discussed. But what about according to Ramban? So the Ramban writes that Gan Eden is the pristine and perfect place for achieving the intellectual understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Just like Eretz Yisrael is the ideal place for achieving Nevuah and spiritually connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, emotionally connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Gan Eden is the ultimate place for intellectually understanding the truth and connecting to God in that way. And we suggested that's why Gan Eden is different than Eretz Yisrael. Gan Eden is even in Chutz Laretz. We considered parallels between Bavel and Gan Eden and the like. We also talked about how Lasid Lavo, this dichotomy between Chutz Laretz and Eretz Yisrael, between the intellectual and the emotional, will be resolved, and solved. In Olam Haba, in other words, both, there's no longer that stira. We have a physical and a spiritual body, and there's no stira between the emotional and the intellectual. We talked about Gehenim. I guess the Rambam's acceptance of Gehenim, the purpose of Gehenim, the nature of Gehenim. Okay, I guess that will be for this first unit. In terms of the issues of Agada and Medrash. So again, we could only very briefly chazer. We talked about, first of all, that there is somewhat of a debate as to whether Midrashim and Agada come from Mesorah or that they were made up. We saw a number of sources, different interpretations of the Yerushalmi that says, Ein lemeidin min ha'agados. We saw some statements among the Gaonim who talk about how Medrash is something that, at least the Midrashic interpretations of Sukkim, are not necessarily based off of Mesorah, but based off of what seemed to be correct according to their authors, and as such are less authoritative. And we talked about whether Ramban and Rambam accepted that view or disagreed with that view. But what we said is that one thing that the Rambam agrees to is that we should see Medrash and Agada as containing very profound wisdom. He writes that there are three groups of people. There are some who take Midrashim literally and are not bothered by them. There are some that have studied science and therefore reject the possibility of Midrashim being literally true and therefore reject Midrashim. And then there's the third possibility, the smallest group of people who understand science and philosophy and understand that Midrashim oftentimes cannot be understood literally, but also don't dismiss them. Rather, they recognize that they contain great wisdom and seek to try to understand that wisdom. And that's the approach of the Rambam. And we noted how, in many ways, this is very similar to the approach that the Maharal takes in a number of places concerning the study of Medrash. A lot of times Maharal and Rambam are set up as being dichotomies, but in fact there is a lot of overlap. We talked about disagreeing with Chazal in terms of Midrashim and the like. The Stiras and the Rambam's were in the Vuchim about that. And how the Rambam writes that seemingly in a number of places where he's disagreeing with Chazal, he doesn't actually disagree. He says that view on Chazal is a das yachid, but I am telling you the majority opinion. We know that we gave four examples of that. We said at first glance that seems to be very dismissive or apologetical, because those views in Chazal don't seem to be disagreed, like the Rashban says about Rambam's rejection concerning the destruction of the world. How could the Rambam say it's a Das Yachid? We don't find anyone that argues with it. The Maharal says, how could the Rambam say that we don't accept the Mishnah that says Al-Kansi Po Yagyu Rachamecha Meshaskino? So if it's a Stam Mishnah. And we showed how the Rambam's response to this was that you have to look at Chazal and understand their view, broadly speaking. Meaning to say that you can't look at it narrowly. In all four of those cases where the Rambam says that he rejects this particular view in Chazal because it's a Das Yachid, he shows how if you look at the perspective of Chazal, broadly speaking, not just isolating one particular medrash or line in a medrash, but look at things more broadly, then you have a very different perspective. And that was the Rambam's view with respect to Chazal. It's important that we look at things more broadly speaking, and that being the case, you might find lines or passages that don't reflect the broader view of Chazal. And finally, we discussed the issue of Psak in Haggadah. We noted that the Chovos Halvavos writes that there is no such thing as Psak when it comes to Haggadah, and that is because Psak only makes sense in terms of Halacha. And he writes that's because Haggadah, there isn't a Mesorah, and again, perhaps reflecting the Gaonic tradition, whereas Halacha there is. We saw that Rav Kook points out that that might be the view of the Bavli, but the Yerushalmi disagrees. The Yerushalmi invokes the pasuk that the Chovos Halvavos cites and uses it to derive that there is Psak even when it comes to matters of Haggadah. Rav Kook understood that the disagreement was the perspective of Chutz Laaretz versus Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael, where we relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through Nevuah and in a more emotional way, calls for Psak and Mesorah when it comes to non-halachic matters, whereas Chutz Laaretz is related to God through a more intellectual way, which therefore does not require the same level of Mesorah and denies the possibility for Psak. And then we suggested an alternative way of understanding the machlokas between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi as to whether this psak in matters of Haggadah, that might relate to two different understandings of what the purpose of psak is. Is psak just normative to figure out what to do practically? In which case one could say that if there's no practical nafkamina, so then there's no point in arriving at a psak, and that might be the view of the Bavli that says we don't paskin in matters of Haggadah when there is no practical psak. Sometimes there is, in which case we'll get there in a moment, but other times, perhaps much of the time, there isn't, and that's why we don't paskin it. The alternative is that no, psak is in and of itself a cheftz of Torah. It's trying to understand the MS, and therefore, even when it comes to non-halachic matters where there isn't necessarily a normative nafkamina, we should try to understand the psak. We consider this in light of the machlokas amorayim and rishonim with respect to hilchos l'mashicha. Why would we paskin hilchos l'mashicha if there's no nafkamina nowadays? Either one view says no, we don't, because psak is only to figure out the normative law. And the other possibility is no, that psak is about trying to understand the MS, and therefore it makes sense to arrive at psak in matters that there is no nafkamina, whether it's with respect to halacha, vis-a-vis hilchasa de mashicha, and with respect to hashkafa, namely matters of psak and medrash and Haggadah. We talked about how these two perspectives might very much relate to conceptions of the concept of Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim. The Ritva's perspective, based off of the Yerushalmi, is that Elu Ve'elu means that both opinions are equally true. They both come from Sinai, they both come from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And they're both equally true, in which case it would make sense to say that psak isn't relevant if there's no normative difference. Means to say that they're both equally true. We need to paskin like Beis Hillel because we need a normative practice, but not that Beis Hillel is any more true than Beis Shammai. The alternative we saw in the Drash Saran that states no, one position is more true than the other. And when we vote and we say Achram Lahatos, it's because we hope that the position that the majority reaches is in fact more true. It doesn't make sense to say both positions are equally true. Now the Ran at the same time acknowledges halachic autonomy, and based off of the Gemara in Tanur Shel Achnai and other Gemaras, he says that even if we were to theoretically know that the true position is against the majority, we would still follow the majority, and that's because Lo Bashamayim, he that God Torah was given to the Jewish people to independently assess. Nevertheless, we're not saying both are equally true, and according to that, from that perspective, it would make a lot of sense perhaps to pursue psak even in matters where there isn't any normative nafkamina. One last point on this we mentioned is the Rambam. The Rambam writes that in many places that we don't paskin matters of Agada for which there's no nafkamina. But we noted that many matters of Hashkafa are paskin in the Rambam, among them the Yud Gimel Ikar Yemuna and the like, where someone who doesn't accept the Yud Gimel Ikar Yemuna has the halachic status of a kofer. And their psak is absolutely necessary because it's halachic nafkamina with respect to their shchita being valid or lending them money beribis or whether the wine that they touch is kosher and so on and so forth. So that being the case, it's extremely important to arrive at psak halacha in those matters of theology, since there is actually a very important practical difference. And then the third matter we just did today, so I don't think we need a chazer. In terms of the... I'm sorry? Bechirat Yisrael. Yeah, Bechirat Yisrael. So we just finished that. Do we need a chazer? It's still... No? Well, very good, sir. Why not? Okay. It's true. So we talked about how when we look, very much relates to our discussion today of Pshat and Drash, when we look at the Pshuto Shel Mikra concerning both the Bechir of Kal Yisrael and the Bechir of Avram Avinu, we find that no reasons are given for this chosenness for the most part. Avram Avinu is selected to found a nation, to be part of a bris olam, without the Torah ever telling us why he was chosen. Now, to be sure, later on we find out how great he was, in fact. But his initial selection is left without reason. It's inscrutable. Whereas when we look at Chazal, we get the opposite impression. We see that Avraham Avinu was the greatest person ever to live before HaKadosh Baruch Hu first spoke to him. And how do we reconcile these two approaches? And we suggested that perhaps there are two dimensions to Bechiras Yisrael. One, which is inscrutable, which goes beyond reason. This relates to Kal Yisrael becoming a nation. Because the reason for their chosenness is not given, then it's going to be eternal. When I make a decision based off of reason, if the reason is no longer valid, then the choice is no longer valid. HaKadosh Baruch Hu chooses Avram not as an individual, but to form a nation and to form an eternal covenant. And thus, to give the reason would be misleading. It would imply that it's Ava Shetluya Bedavar, not Ava Sheina Tluya Bedavar. At the same time, it was also true that Avraham Avinu was the greatest person ever to live. And that needs to be understood, which is why the Medrash fills in the details. We stated that perhaps these two perspectives on Bechira could be seen in two of the metaphors used to describe the relationship between Am Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Klal Yisrael is compared both to the child of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Banim Atem LaHashem Elokecha, Bani Bechor Yisrael, and also the spouse of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, like in Shir HaShirim. The spousal relationship is A, something which is initially dependent upon reason. You choose a spouse because of their qualities. And B, because it's dependent upon reasoning, is subject to ending. There is such a thing as divorce. Whereas the parent-child relationship is not based on reason. You love your child from the moment they're born, not because they've done anything. And therefore, it's by definition irrevocable and unbreakable. The position in the Gemara in Kiddushin that we saw, that even when we're banim mumrim, banim mashchisim, and the like, we're still banim, is reflective of this. And we said that this dichotomy not only exists with respect to the reason and the metaphor, but also with respect to the halacha. When it comes to certain areas of halacha, we say mumr hu ke'akum l'chol davar, that someone who rejects Judaism and rejects Torah is treated like a guy, and many halachos reflect that. And at the same time, we also have this principle of Yisrael, afal pi shechata Yisrael hu, the concept that a person can never totally lose their Jewishness. And that too is a reflection of the same duality and the same dichotomy. We talked about in this concept at length whether HaKadosh Baruch Hu did divorce us, the Psukim in Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu, and potential contradictions between the two. Then we turned to the Kuzari, and we spent a lot of time assessing Kuzari's complex perspective. Kuzari understands that initially man, Adam HaRishon, was created as the Bechir Elokim, the perfect creation with this Inyan Eloki. The Inyan Eloki, which allows for prophecy and connecting to God in a spiritual fashion, was passed on to some of his progeny, but not all of it. Just like a seed, or in genetics, where certain traits are passed on and certain traits aren't, certain traits will be latent and only be seen if the right environmental conditions are present, and certain traits will skip generations. So too with respect to the Inyan Eloki. We talked about the idea that the Inyan Eloki relates to prophecy, and that's what makes us as Jews special. We talked about, well, what about nowadays? We don't have prophecy. Is there any relevance to the Inyan Eloki anymore? And we saw that on the one hand, the Kuzari writes that we're in Klal Yisrael, in Galus, are like dead people because we lack that Inyan Eloki. But at the same time, the Kuzari also says that it's not limited to Nevuah. We saw his stress on mitzvos and the like. Within the Kuzari, that process continued until Yaakov Avinu. And with Yaakov Avinu, so then all of his children inherited the Inyan Eloki, Mitaso Shlema, and that would go on in Klal Yisrael. So every Jew has at least this potential to connect to God in this fashion and achieve prophecy, whereas non-Jews do not. Non-Jews could still achieve greatness intellectually and morally, but not necessarily in the spiritual sense, especially with prophecy. We talked about Kuzari's position with respect to Geirus, that because the Ger was not born Jewish, so he lacks his Inyan Eloki, and prophecy is therefore definitionally impossible. We noticed how the Rambam disagreed. But even among those who accepted the Kuzari's spiritual conception, or that the Jewish neshama is fundamentally different than the non-Jewish neshama, they disagreed with his conclusions with respect to Geirus, that Geirus could potentially achieve prophecy. And we saw two models to explain how that is, either because Kekatan Shinoladami and the Ger gets a new neshama at Geirus, or because it was Iglai Milsal Mafreya, that he was always destined for Geirus, as the Gemara says, even the Neshamos of Geirim or the Mazalos of Geirim were at Har Sinai, B'Shas Matan Torah. Hence we saw the Gemara explains that the Geirim are punished for delaying their conversion and the like. We talked about why there is a need for a hierarchy in creation, both point to the Kuzari and the Rambam. And in concluding the Kuzari, we considered a really fascinating idea, namely that there are two aspects to Bechiras Yisrael. These may parallel the first two aspects we noted, and namely that on the one hand we are B'ni Bechor Yisrael, which means to say that like a Bechor, we're the first of many children, and we have a responsibility towards the rest of the world, but we're part of them. And also, Am Levadad Yishkon, that we're wholly apart. That many of the sources that stress the that stress our responsibility towards the rest of the world are a reflection of this Bnei Bechor Yisrael, and other sources which stress our uniqueness, like the Kuzari, are a reflection of the second aspect of who we are, in which we're totally different. We're not on the same field. We talked about in this context Rav Fisher's fascinating explanation of the Nevuah of Yaskil Avdi. According to Rashi, we saw that Klal Yisrael suffer for the sins of the nations. Radak rejects that. It's totally unjust. Why should they sin and we suffer? And he suggested that that's because we are to some degree responsible for their sins, because we are not the Mamlechas Kohanim, that we should have been, we're the Or Lagayim. And that's true with respect to this dimension. And we talked about at length the different possibilities of understanding vicarious atonement and who the suffering servant was and the Christian polemics and the like. In terms of the Rambam and unchosenness, we spoke about how the Rambam does not stress the idea that the spiritual soul is different. He focuses more on mitzvos. He says, in terms of why were we chosen, that's something that we can't ultimately know. It's a mystery. But he too focused on the inherent difference, both with respect to midos and the like. So we compared and contrasted Rambam and Kuzari. We talked about that the Rambam's position that in Hakdamat Pirush Mishnayis, that non-philosophers are there to serve philosophers, and in Hakdamat Pirush Mishnayis in Bava Kamma, that non-Jews are there to support Jews. The Rambam's position at the same time that that Kol Boy Olam can achieve incredible spiritual potential, that anyone who wants the Rambam at the end of Shemitah V'Yovel, who wants to separate themselves and devote themselves to the service of God, could do so. We talked about the potential then, both in terms of the physical world. We saw the Tiferes Yisrael that discussed the many great inventions of non-Jews, like Sir Francis Drake's bringing the potato to Israel, to Europe, and the cure of smallpox, as well as their spiritual potential and contributions. And finally, we discussed how we find many places where the Torah itself is very, very much concerned with the welfare of non-Jews and also their opinions. The notion of Kiddush Hashem, Ma Yomer HaGoyim, the Jews are spared because the Goyim will think that that God destroyed them because of his weakness and the like. And why is it that their positions are so important? And in this context, we discussed the views of the Maharal and Rav Kook. What does it mean, Selam Elokim? Maharal and other mystical thinkers seem to understand that based off of the principle of Atam Kuyam Adam Ein Umas Olam Kuyam Adam, that even the Mishnah of Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tselem might not be true after the Bechir of Kal Yisrael, but at the same time we saw both in Maral and Rav Kook that despite stressing the vast difference between Jew and non-Jew, nevertheless they also, especially Rav Kook, stresses the potential of Umos Olam and in fact his own personal love of Goyim. And we saw it, we tried to explain how it's not a stira, that one can focus on the incredible difference between Jew and non-Jew in terms of their neshama and the like, and at the same time recognize and acknowledge the value and the importance and the contribution and God's concern for non-Jew along with Jew. All right. There's more to say, but I need to leave you guys with some chazar for your own. And also I have to get going because I'm running a little late. But thank you very, very much for the Chazara, for a great semester, and Bezras Hashem will continue. Have a good Shabbos and Hatzlacha Rabba on the Bechina.